the phone today with recording artist Alyssa Graham. Alyssa, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Chuck. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking your time and joining us today. I know that you're not a new artist by any means, but I'm. Yeah, you've been around for a long time, but there's a lot of our listeners that come to our site that may not know you. Can you give some background on how music came about and how it became a part of your life?
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, it's funny that you say that because I was just talking to somebody else about how, you know, they always write these articles like, out of the clear blue sky, this new artist, and those artists have usually been around for 20 years working their ass off, but... I can start way back, but I was a musician from, you know, the get-go. I studied piano and guitar when I was growing up. I was really influenced by a lot of the folk music that my parents played, lots of Bob Dylan and Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon. And then I was also introduced to jazz by my parents. My dad took me when I was really young to see Ella Fitzgerald. So I had the bug early on, and when I got a hold of a guitar for the first time, that was just, you know, a huge connection and motion towards me becoming a musician. And then I spent a lot of time with a eclectic original band while I was in college called Blind Man's Holiday that, I don't know, maybe some of your listeners heard of that way back. We were sort of on the college circuit, and it was really fun, but at some point I decided I wanted to get a little more serious and go to study jazz. So I went to New England Conservatory, studied jazz. This is the short version. Came out of New England Conservatory and recorded my first record, which was called Echo. And it was sort of a mixture between singer-songwriter stuff and jazz. We had a great producer who is a well-known jazz musician named John Coward, and he produced the record. And so there were these really simple songs that became very big jazz compositions, and that record did really well, and then about 2 years after that, we're up to date. So now we have just finished a new project called the Lock, Stock, and Soul EP, and it is part of what will come out as a LP, I think in January, but it comes out August 23rd next week, exclusively on iTunes, and this record is really us, you know, coming home. I mean, the last project, a lot of people refer to it as a travelogue, and it was us exploring different kinds of music and different experiences we've had around the world. And this project is us getting back to our essential roots, which is really folk and singer-songwriter music. And it's very simple, and it was recorded with an amazing group of musicians, including Michelle and Diggy Cello, which as a bass player, I'm sure you're a fan. And it was produced by the wonderful Craig Street, and it's just a really, it was recorded live, and it has all the great imperfections that I love about music, and hopefully other people will love that too.
Yeah, where did that Lock, Stock, and Soul title come from?
Well, that's like an insight into the full record. There is a track called Lock, Stock, and Soul that's going to be on the full LP that will have, I think, 12 or 13 tracks on it that will come out in January.
Yeah, did I read that you had 10 tracks and you thought that was good enough, and then somebody wanted you to have 20?
Well, I don't know that we thought 10 was good enough, but we had, when we started pre-production with Craig Street, we left New York City and we moved up to Ithaca, which happens to be a place that Doug and I lived for years, and it was just coincidence that that's where Craig, the producer, lives. So we shot up there for about 3 months, and we brought about 10 songs that we'd been working on, and we knew we were gonna be up there for 3 months in pre-production, so we knew we were going to write more and develop more material, but we thought we'd go into the studio with maybe 10, 12 tracks and just record them. And Craig's philosophy is, no, you go into the studio with double what you need, and you record as much as you can, and then you pick the best tracks, which is a really great method, because if you go into the studio with just 12 tracks, which I've done before, even if you're not happy with one or two of those tracks, they're going on the record.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked for 3 months, the two of us, on developing more material, and Craig brought in this wonderful singer-songwriter from Austin. His name is David Garza, and he's just a brilliant, he's a brilliant writer, and we partnered with him, and Jesse Harris has a track on the record as well, and we went into the studio with, I think, 25 tracks, and we recorded about 19 of them. We only had 4 days live in the studio, so we recorded as many as we could, and we chose our favorites, the ones that really expressed the message we were trying to get across.
Now, that's interesting that you say that you just recorded it live, because, you know, nowadays you have a lot of musicians who just want to isolate, track by track by track. What made you really want to just record it live? When you say live, did you just get pretty much all your musicians in there and just recorded it live that way?
Well, I'm probably one of those people who wanted to do the isolation. But Craig he works in mysterious ways, and what he did was ingenious. And, you know, we grew up sitting around campfires and singing songs and playing guitars in circles of friends, and Craig really got to know us, Doug and I, as people, and he wanted to recreate the most comfortable environment for us. So what we did was we all sat in a circle in the middle of this old church called Dreamland Studios in Woodstock that's now become an amazing studio. We sat in the middle of this room in a circle, and there was no isolation. And we recorded the 18 or whatever the amount of tracks we recorded. And, of course, at the beginning of the sessions, Craig said to me, you know, just sing and have fun with it. It came out of there, and Craig said, you're done. And I said, what are you talking about? I'm going to re-record the things that I'm not happy with. He said, do me a favor, go home. Listen to it. And I got to tell you, for the first, like, 2 or 3 days, as a trained musician, all I heard were the imperfections, the pitch problems, or the phrasing problems that I didn't like, and I focused on those, and about 3 or 4 days later, the things that I was focusing on, those imperfections, were the beauty of the project, and I would never in a million years remove them, because they're the parts of the music that make it real and honest, and so that was it. So Craig did that on purpose, because he knew how to get out of me that natural that he was going for.
So that brings me to asking you, there was that one point in time when you had that record deal and you walked out because of the creative control thing, right?
It wasn't so much about creative control. It was more about what I think they wanted to turn me into.
Mm-hmm.
There were negotiations, and we were in the studio already working on a few tracks, and every day there would be somebody who would come into the studio and say, Alyssa, could you sound a little more like so-and-so, or could you give us that little baby voice that some of the female singers have these days? And you know, this was really frustrating as an artist who wants to really get a message across and portray who I am personally and musically to people. And then the last straw was sort of a business meeting we had with the, you know, the people at the label, who basically said, well, now all I have to do is get a choreography team together and, you know, put some dance moves. And my jaw just dropped. And I thought of doing, not that I think there's anything wrong with people putting dance moves to music, but it's just not me. And Doug and I reached a crossroads when we walked out of that meeting, and we just looked at each other and we said, we can make this decision right now to give up the possibility of being on a billboard in Times Square, and maybe we won't play the late show or something like that, but we'll have a life career of being the artists we want to be. And so we chose to, you know, stay true to who we are. And who knows if it was the right decision, but it's a lot more fun to be an artist when you can convey the music you want to convey.
So it wasn't really about the creative control of the music, because you still have the control of the music. It's just an image type of thing?
It was partially image.
Well, I'll definitely say that I like what I've heard off of Echo, and I like what I've heard off of the EP thus far.
Thank you.
Really
also
good.
Maybe we chose the right path.
Yep. Well, I'm one that's looking forward to the full album on Lock, Stock, and Soul. So, hey, speaking of the Echo album and your EP, and image and all that stuff, definitely see a different image, a different picture, or is this a different side of you from Echo, which seemed like this mature, grown-up person, and now we have this totally different look of, I'm here, I'm crazy, I'm ready to go, and then you just read some of the, you know, the few titles that you have right now, and you're going, wow, what change, what direction is this? Because I like it.
Well, I think it's an artist's prerogative to continuously change with the music, you know, in their appearance and in the sound, obviously. But I agree with you. I think that the imagery that went along with the album Echo, I believe that the label and the people putting the record out there wanted to appeal to a mature audience because they saw it as part of the jazz world. Those pictures were taken by a friend, and they just used what they wanted to use that they thought would market to a more mature jazz audience, even though I wouldn't consider Echo a jazz record. I would consider, you know, I don't know what I would consider it, but people love to put labels and genres. And the new record is just fun. You know, we had this really 70s, 60s, 70s vibe going from the material we were writing to the way it was recorded in sort of a hippie communal setting, and to the way that the engineer really mixed the project. It has a very sort of, I think somebody said at one point, a Laurel Canyon sort of feel to it, a throwback. So the new imagery that you see, I think, was being playful and grabbing on to that 1670s sort of, retro girl thing.
I definitely see it, and especially since you're using black and white imagery, that it works really well. It does. Now, as far as touring goes, you will be out there in support of the new record, correct?
Yes, we will. The dates will be announced pretty soon. We're going to do some fall dates that are intimate settings, probably about 8 to 10 shows that are just introducing people to the new material and supporting the EP. And then after the record comes out in January, which I'm not sure what the release date is, but sometime in January, we'll do the full national tour and hopefully an international tour. And I know the record's coming out, I think, in November in Japan already, so we'll be going, hopefully around the world.
You know, since it's the full record will be released in Japan in November, you think? Is that what you're saying?
I believe that's what they're shooting for, yeah.
Then speaking of international and, you know, back home here in the States, do you have a stronger hold then over in the Asian countries? Is that why that's going to be released there first?
No, I think that, and I'm not sure if I'm misspeaking. I was told, I think, that it's coming out in November in Japan. I think that the Japanese market has a different criteria for when they release products. I mean, here, it's usually difficult to release an indie artist in the fourth quarter because most of the media is focused on the Christmas albums and the big stars who are doing around the Grammys and stuff like that. So I think that it's different in Japan, and this was just the schedule I think they've come up with Sunnyside. The label over there is Yamaha. So, I try really hard to stay out of the whole business part of it.
Sure.
But I'm sure there's a method to their madness.
I'm sure there must be and has to be.
Yeah.
Now, will you be planning on, since I'm out on the West Coast and we have a lot of readers and followers out here, do you think you're going to be out anywhere along the West Coast?
Oh, I hope so. My brother lives in San Francisco, and I love Washington State. I mean, I think it's, we did a whole tour last summer, just Doug and I, just a duo, and we played somewhere in Bellingham, and we played in Seattle, and I have to say, and I'm not just saying this, but Washington State is the most beautiful state in this country. Just the hiking that we got to do with our dog out there, and so I'm sure that we'll be out there because I'll push it hard.
Good. We hope so. Now,
yes, you guys are lucky. Washington State is so beautiful, and we went through Montana and Wyoming and Utah, and those are great, but there's something so majestic about Washington that we just fell in love.
Well, that's nice. That's good. But be careful. We have a lot of other listeners, too.
I love all the places we went, but for Doug and I, there was something magical about Washington State.
Now, do you and Doug write a lot when you're on the road, or is that writing process done when you're done touring, or how does that come about for the two of you?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I was just telling somebody else that I heard this NPR interview that was Isabel Allende speaking about inspiration and how writers get their inspiration, whether it's the musician or the novelist. And her quote was, inspiration is for amateurs. You know, there are lots of ways to interpret that, but I think for Doug and I, we try to write every day. So it's nice to say you can sit around and wait for inspiration to hit you, and sometimes it does, it's great, but I think that the other way to do it, which is what we try to commit to, is to write a little every day, and some days you get some great stuff, and some days you just, you know, want to shoot yourself. But generally, when we're on tour or even when we're in the studio recording, we're still writing pretty much on a daily basis. And when the right thing hits, you never know when it's going to be. But I think that we're those kinds of artists that try to commit to writing a little bit every day.
I mean, we've got two of these titles on your upcoming EP that seem like they're almost like polar opposites, where you read the title, Till My Heart Aches, and then High Time. So how did those two kind of come about? I mean, it was pulling from
Till My Heart Quakes, and it's funny that you said aches because...
Or quakes, sorry, yes.
But I think, you know, that Till My Heart Quakes was actually written by W. Garza, and it's just one of those songs that I attached to right away when he was writing for the record, and it could be my favorite tune on the record. But High Time is a funny story because it's the only cover song on the EP and on the LP, actually, and it's a Grateful Dead cover tune. I don't know if you have any Grateful Dead fans. If you reach, you know, a wide audience, I'm sure there's tons of Grateful Dead fans that listen. But Craig Street, when we were talking about material for the album, he was, like I said, getting to know us and our past and where we came from musically. And one of the things I shared with him was that Doug and I used to go see a lot of Dead shows. And it was something that I could sort of shy away from talking about when I... you know, was putting out a quasi-jazz album. But Craig is an outspoken non-fan of the Grateful Dead, and he came to our house one day when we were working, and he said, okay, I want you to try to do an arrangement of this Grateful Dead song. And we were like, what? What are you talking about? We're so over, you know, we haven't listened to the Grateful Dead in so long. It's so part of our past, and you hate the Grateful Dead. So he's like, I know, and that's why this is a really good song, and it's part of your guys' background, it's part of your history, I want you to work on it. So we spent a while going back and forth saying, no, we're not going to do this, and we finally came up with an arrangement, and we got into the studio and got Chris Bruce and Michelle on the part. It just was, it was one of those just blow-your-mind moments in the studio where he was an essential part of the album, so... It was funny for us to go back to our roots and do a Grateful Dead track, and it's the only cover on the album, and in a million years I never thought I'd cover the Grateful Dead, but here we are.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken as far as with the lyrics on that, I guess it does go along with maybe your entire recording or music history, which I'm having a hard time living the good life, well, I know, and... Because, you know, I was losing time. I had nothing to do.
That's right. And I'm definitely having a high time. So,
It's very good. Earlier, before we even started the actual interview, you know, I mentioned to you that I sent this out to a couple of close friends, some links, and, you know, their comments were that your voice, whether it was from Echo or the upcoming EP, that is very, very soulful. Is that, I mean, that's you, are you always going to keep that soulful voice? And I know it sounds strange when I say, are you always going to keep that? It just seems like a lot of times the artists, when they make a little change, or, you know, you look at your visual from then till now, and it's different, but you've kept that soul, that feeling.
I believe that artists can change their appearance and change the music they write, but, you know, I was born with the voice that I have, and I can't see me ever going and singing rap music or hard rock or anything like that, so I think that the music might morph and change and grow with what experiences I have in my life, but I don't think that the tone or sound quality of my voice is going to change that much. I might learn to phrase something differently than people are used to, or express myself a little differently in the delivery, but whatever your friend is saying, I mean, it's a nice compliment to say there's soul in my voice. I think that's just innate to who I am,
Okay.
I don't think it'll change.
We're happy. We're glad.
Thank you.
For the last thing, being an indie artist, how's this internet affected you? I mean, as an artist, has it helped as far as getting the word out? But then on the flip side, has it hurt as far as, and I hate to say it, but monetarily? I mean, you have your videos posted and recordings, and now people could just listen to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line. I know that there are different schools of thought on how the internet has affected artists and the money they make, and, you know, and on the flip side, how it's affected them getting out to more people. I think for me, obviously, it's nice to see a profit from a record that you make, but I look at it more on a long-term trajectory. I like to know that the music is spreading to as many people as possible, and I just have faith that the more people that hear the music, the more our name will get out there and our career will grow, and eventually, you know, we'll get our fair share. I think that the internet is amazing for independent artists because it really gives them a platform to, you know, get out there, and I think it's changed the industry completely, where the artists are really seeing more fans and more ways to personally have connections to their fans, and that's, for me, that's what it's all about. I know that there are different ways of thinking about what's important as an artist when, you know, how to reach people, but for me, I would rather have the widespread connection to people who are really interested in listening to my music than worry about, you know, how much money is coming in because somebody's downloading it for free, or, you know, and this whole new thing with Spotify that I've been learning about myself. You know, some people are for it, some people aren't, as far as the artists and the industry. For me, something like opening up to a market that maybe I wouldn't have access to without something like Spotify, I'm happy to get the music out there. So go ahead, download it. Send it to your friends. I don't care.
Well, you know,
spread the music.
That, you know, we really appreciate that. And not that you're saying, hey, take it, but we really appreciate that you as an artist is doing this not for the money, really, but because you are an artist and you want to create something for yourself and for the rest of us to listen to and enjoy. So we thank you very much.
Thank you guys for listening and spreading it. I mean, that's, you know, I grew up, like I said, sitting around a campfire and playing music with friends and, you know, and swapping tapes of artists that we loved. And, you know, it's always been a factor. People have always been sending music to their friends, whether it be a mixtape or whatever. And for me, it's all about getting the music out there and getting people to connect to it. So more power to you.